Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the Tuesday night edition of TS Radio. As you know, we cover a lot of topics and we talk about a lot of things, and over the last two or three years that I've been on the air, one of the things that has irked me to no end has been vaccines, what it's doing to our children. At one point, I'd had Eileen Banneman from Vaccine Liberation Army on, who had made a very profound statement that we are raising an entire generation of damaged children. And one of the ways they are harmed and damaged is vaccines. I believe that with all my heart. And so tonight, I've got a very, very special guest with us, and that's Dr. Andrew Maniotis. And I want to welcome you to the show, Dr. Maniotis. And the first thing I would like you to do is to give your credentials. I think that's extremely important, and you can do it far better and more accurately because yours are extensive than I can. Well, so if you could do that for us, I would appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Ms. Oakley. I'll start with my youth, which was spent with music and the arts and all that, until I sat in a geology class one day and I said, why am I not doing science? So I got a degree in anthropology in Washington University as my bachelor's degree. And then I worked in a lab for a few years, or several labs, to better understand what kind of science I wanted to do, since I had not really thought as a youth I'd be going into science. And I worked in a neural regeneration lab, a pretty famous one that ended up being funded by a football player to do spinal cord regeneration research. And then another lab, the laboratory of John Olney, who some of your audience may know through his work on aspartame and glutamate. And he was the one responsible for getting glutamate banned from baby food. And then he sounded the alarm bells for Donald Rumsfeld's aspartame through Searle, and then bought up by Monsanto. And we did a lot of seizure research and mapping of the brain and how the brain is damaged by these excitatory amino acids. And then I decided to get serious. I went to Berkeley, California. I got a PhD there in cell biology, and I studied those little division centers inside cells, and that made a little splash, but it's a century-old problem as to how these little centers are inherited, because they are the harbingers of two-ness in cells. They replicate before anything else does, and they are responsible for the cells dividing. And I acquired a lot of skill at microsurgery on cells at that time, and so I was then hired at Harvard Medical School in the laboratory of Judah Folkman and Donald Ingber, and we pioneered the sciences of anti-angiogenesis and tensegrity architecture in living systems. And I spent about 7 years there at Harvard, and then I went to University of Iowa, where I got my first faculty appointment. I got lucky there. My team and I, we discovered this process that tumors make their own blood vessels, and through a process I called vasculogenic mimicry. And others since then, there's about 280 groups throughout the world now that use this phenomenon to stage malignant tumors, and they call it the fluid conducting meshwork. And it's made by the tumor cells and not the body, unfortunately, as we had hoped that during the anti-angiogenesis development at Harvard. And following the stay at Iowa, I went to University of Illinois at Chicago, where I was the director of the Cell and Developmental Biology of Cancer Program, and the in the pathology department there, and the Efficient Causes and Design Consortium in Bioengineering, where we made all kinds of test kits and launched into therapeutic reversal of cancer and detection of viruses at the physical nucleic acid level of genes and things like that. And we also started a lot of regeneration research into how to regenerate milk glands from tumor cells of the breast, and how to regenerate the immune system from the gut, essentially the ileum of the small intestine. And that work was, put forward as a hope that we could regenerate people's immune systems that had been damaged or destroyed by so-called proven cancer therapies, including radiation and drugging and toxic drugs, and also AIDS patients whose immune systems were characterized, I should say, by a destruction of what are called the lymph nodes in the gut, the Peyer's patches in particular, and other lymph nodes. And so AIDS became a new definition under some of this thinking, such that the viruses and things like that were only of minor interest or importance compared to the fibrosis, which forms in the lymph nodes, much as it does in a malignant cancer. I mean, the hallmark of malignant cancer is they form these channels I call vasculogenic mimicry channels, but they're filled with a matrix, sort of like a glue, and that's a fibrotic reaction, much like cirrhosis or alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver. And since then, I've been actively working for several foundations. One is called, we just changed the name from Partnerships to Cures, for Cures, excuse me, to Cures Within Reach here in Chicago. And another foundation I'm very heavily involved with is the Office of Medical and Scientific Justice with Clark Baker and L.A., situated in L.A. And these things keep me busy. And in the process, you know, in my own research, I needed to know about vaccines. I needed to understand the association of vaccines with cancer. And veterinary societies and myself, we had conferences because the same molecules that are found in dogs and cats that develop tumors at the injection sites are the same molecules we found that can accelerate or reverse cancers. And so I've been working also with veterinary societies such as the American Medical Veterinary Association and Canine Health Concern in Great Britain and some in Australia on trying to get a better understanding of how the relationship between vaccines and tumor initiation. And so that pretty much, well, you know, brings me up to the current day. And I've written a number of books. They're free on my website. I feel it's my responsibility to share these books with the public. And at some point, I hope during the show, I can maybe share that website URL with people.
And, well, please do that now.
Okay,
go ahead,
the website is Andrew Maniotis, all one word. I'll spell it, AndrewManiotis.wordpress.com. And there's a number of books on vaccines, epidemics, FDA issues concerning, you know, the health of individuals versus the protection of populations. And a special book I've written recently on Gardasil, or as I entitled it, Sacrifice of the Virgins. And there's some other interesting free books there that I invite anyone to analyze at your leisure. And also, if you do, please contact me, and let's discuss alternatives or ideas that you may have. Again, it's andrewmaniotis.wordpress.com.
Excellent. I had put links to your free e-books up on the promotion for the site on the PBJ Gazette. And if you go to this website, I'm going to tell you there is such a wall of information there that at first you might be a little bit put off, but once you start reading, you realize it isn't written in the dry, mechanical, my God, when is this going to be over with, format that many people with this high level of education write with. These are very readable documents, very understandable in plain language, and I encourage everyone to take the time and go there and read these books, and you can link to them right off the front page, I say, of the PPJ on the show promo. And probably what I'll do, Dr. Maniotis, is put links to them in my sidebar, because I do think they're important.
Well, thank you very much, Marty. Writing is difficult.
it doesn't sound like it is. And you one of the things I appreciated about your writing was the fact that it was written so somebody like me who has no science education. Everything I know, I have had to learn just thumbing my way through this stuff. And I know very, very little. Most of what's out there in the form of medical or scientific writings is unreadable. I think even by the people in the communities, by anybody's standards, it is so, like I say, so mechanical, so formatted, predictable too many times, but it's so dry that you just cannot get through it. And there may be points of interest in it. Yours, on the other hand, you write in a very conversational manner, and it makes assimilating the information you're giving out quite easy.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
So I appreciated that. Like I say, as someone who doesn't have this kind of education, I appreciate someone who does being able to put it out in a form that I can understand.
Well, there's a reason for what you're describing, Marty, and the reason is that you know, science, when it's done well and explained well, should be explicable to the man on the street or the woman on the street corner if the concepts are well understood and they're within reach of experimentalism. The problem you're describing, though, has to do with the balkanization and the reductionism of science. I mean, we used to write 40 drafts before submitting a paper to a journal or something like that. And the language, as you say, is highly coded, individual to specific fields, so that one field can't read the literature of another field without a great deal of, you know, checking and difficulty and this sort of thing. So there's a reason why a lot of the writing is so difficult.
Well, legal writing is the same way. I've always said that anybody that could, even the Supreme Court can't read their rulings and decipher what they said. You know, I never saw such a perversion of language in my life. But one of my great concerns in the last few years has been the Gardasil vaccine. Mm-hmm. And this is just an abomination in my estimation. And you had written something in here in your Sacrifice of the Virgins. And you said you were talking about Merck claiming, and this had to have been sometime after the fact, 100% protective efficacy, which is not the same thing as efficiency, I understand, for its Gardasil vaccine, unless the patient isn't a virgin. I have never, in all the reading and research I have done, seen that. And you said, if this is the case, we are told, then all bets are off, according to Merck. I have never seen that anywhere before, that these girls that they're doing this to have to be a virgin. What if they aren't? I mean, is anybody checking?
Well, how do you check if a young lady is a virgin? I mean, there are ways of doing that medically, but it's all done through fear tactics and browbeating. And I've received letters from what I would consider at my age, young women throughout the nation who go into the doctor's office and who are essentially coerced into receiving a Gardasil or Cervarix vaccine. And they are treated like, Mary Magdalene, essentially, if they admit or even allude to the fact that they may have had some kind of intimate relationships with another human being. So it's an absolute travesty to say such a thing that, if you've already shared fluids with another person, then this vaccine cannot protect you. It's completely irrational and illogical. And yes, it's the same company, the original Merck Gardasil, that was promoted as 100% effective in big newspapers throughout the country, such as the Chicago Tribune, without any kind of safety testing, without any kind of long-term follow-up, and without any real demonstration that the so-called human papillomavirus is responsible for cancers, or it cannot be cleared, or it has anything to do with clinical testing of the cervix, called a colposcopy test. And the molecular tests that are used by companies such as Digene are not validated against colposcopy results, and that is an actual observation of the cervix and to see if there is a dysplasia or hyperplasia going on, or a frank cancer of one kind or another. So to say that, you know, only virgins will benefit by this vaccine, it sort of violates rationality itself, because, mm-hmm. You know, if you were to say the same about, say, a a tetanus vaccine or something like that. Let's just posit it the way they do. I mean, this vaccine will work for anybody who's never had a cut. I mean, it would be the same yeah. as saying something like that.
Yes.
Right? And there is no evidence. There's a great deal of evidence of vaccine damage, though. Justice Watches and other organizations have been tabulating all of the adverse events associated with Gardasil, and they're quite profound. They're quite severe because they involve such things as acute dystonias, where there's a huge damage to the nervous system, and seizures. Girls are frequently seen rolling off the table moments after the vaccine. And then, you know, the pharmaceutical industries, they then get behind politicians such as the in Texas and elsewhere, and they mandate that these girls, to protect themselves, and now boys as well, they're trying to push it on young males
yep.
as well, are going to be protected from cancer sometime 40 years down the road, you know, when cervical cancer becomes a more statistically frequent issue. But it may have nothing to do, although they claim 70% of cancers is due to this virus. This is not a new claim. I mean, viruses have always been blamed for many cancers in humans, although in that book, The Sacrifice of the Virgins, I trace the history of cancer viruses up to Gardasil and show that in each and every case, there is no demonstration of a virus that is an inducer, as Roos would have said, Peyton Roos, of cancer. You can't even find the viruses in the cancers. You find DNA cassettes or DNA sequences, but you can also see these things, such as the E6 epitope, which is sort of diagnostic of HPV. You can see these in normal cells of non-infected nuns. As a matter of fact, the first actual control group they tried, I believe, was a group of nuns in Vienna. And obviously, they believed that these nuns were, you know, celibate, and so they should not have any kind of problems. But when you look at a nun,
that was their first mistake. But go ahead.
Well, I don't know about nuns, but. You know, the issue is that normal cells are capable of expressing these kinds of sequences, which are mistaken as exogenous or coming from the outside of the organism, pathogens or viruses and this sort of thing. But there's no evidence that Merck can point to that says that this vaccine will prevent anything, including warts. As a matter of fact, they had several studies from Indonesia showing that the vaccine caused about 50 outbreaks or something like that of genital warts and things like that, because vaccines spread disease extremely efficiently. That's what they can do.
Exactly. And the thing with this thing on Merck is, too, when they first started really pushing it hard for girls, and then they said they were also applying for permission to begin vaccinating boys with it. And, of course, the immediate question that jumped into the public's mind is, what are the chances if they got of getting cervical cancer? And then the third thing that they were trying to get was Gardasil vaccination for middle-aged women.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I think the chances of a middle-aged woman being a virgin are about nil and none.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of blew that. I haven't heard any more about that in particular. But I do know that they did start in on boys. When I had written here last year and probably the year before, too, about Gardasil, because this thing just enraged me. It was just too easy to see something else was going on here, and there wasn't enough evidence of anything for it to have been brought out at all. I got an email from a young lady in Britain, and she said at the time she was 12 years old, and she said, I can't leave the house. She said, thank God. She said, I got my mom to take care of me. But she said, they said we had to get the jab, Gardasil. And she said, after the first shot, she said, I had a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, she's now paralyzed on one side of her body. She's
mm-hmm.
homebound.
Mm-hmm.
She's going blind.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard this. We had the truth about Gardasil mothers on here last year, too, of their kids damaged by this vaccine, many of them dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what bothered me, Dr. Manny Otis, is the way the medical community is treating these people. They have attacked them. They tag-teamed them. They call them liars. The kids are faking. They fudge stuff in their medical records that wasn't there before because the parents have the original records, copies of them, and things have been added to it to indicate that, oh, they probably had a bad heart anyway and we just missed it. Mm. And I see all this going on. There is such a distrust today across the board of the medical community, most especially the pharmaceutical industry, and then getting to the FDA and the World Health Organization and all that, the CDC. People do not trust them, and it's for good reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's for good reason. It's not that they earned this, didn't earn this disrespect. But how? Why? I'm trying to figure out why would your family doctor, we listened to a recording of one doctor just screaming at this girl, you're faking. She was seizing.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out they put her in a room, put a video camera on her 24 hours a day because they were going to prove that she was faking these seizures, and she still has not stopped to this day. Why?
Well, you must appreciate that the Gardasil was touted, is being touted as the first anti-cancer vaccine, okay? But that's not the primary issue, of course. The first vaccine that Merck claimed 20 years ago that was the first anti-cancer vaccine was the hepatitis B vaccine. It was supposed to prevent liver cancer. And if you look at the two studies in Korea and another place in Indonesia, you can see that 20 years ago, the hepatitis B was being given as an anti-cancer vaccine for liver cancer. But you appreciate that, this is the first vaccine that most infants receive. It's among the most dangerous of all vaccines. I've written quite a bit about it, and some of my colleagues and I have also, brought it to the attention of public health agencies throughout the United States with little notice on their part, but except for, violent reactions of the kind you describe. But yet, both hepatitis B and HPV are thought to be sexually transmitted. And so when you get a vaccine, and it's not like chickenpox, it's not like other issues of infectious diseases. I mean, you're talking about a moralistic and behavioral a vaccine that's supposed to address behavioral deficiencies as maybe described by maybe Jesse Helms or somebody who believes that human intimacy and sexuality is something wrong. All right. So that's one reason. I mean, there's a history. Whenever you don't understand something about, the behavior of these organizations, it really helps. It really helps to look at the history. And, it's absurd because Merck forgot that it claimed that Hep B was the first anti-cancer vaccine, and then 20 years later they now claim that Gardasil is. The same company can't remember what they said 20 years ago. Or they think we're so stupid that we can't remember, but we do remember.
Mm-hmm.
And, both vaccines are equally irrational. I mean, the amount of vaccine damage due to Hep B is 100 to 1,000 times more than there is anything resembling a syndrome known as hepatitis B in this nation. And they give it to young babies in the first day of life or the first month of life before the immune system is developed. And, it wreaks havoc in these kids. I've been on, many cases with parents that have been accused of shaken baby syndrome and things like that when the kids are still too young to talk and they develop these horrendous developmental delays and autism and other very morbid conditions, arthritis, diabetes, you name it. All of the sickness going on in our children, as you, I thought, very aptly said in the beginning, we're raising a generation of vegetables here at huge, huge costs to the public school systems and to the parents, of course, of these vaccine-damaged children, whose, my heart goes out to them, and I'm always in touch with one case or another. I mean, right now we're working on the Yurko case. I'd like to give that a little bit of press. He was put in jail for a life sentence for shaking baby, and you know, it's one of the clearest cases of, you know, cerebral bleeding due to a vaccine because of the timing and because of how, you know, the parents were extremely responsible about, you know, taking the kid to the doctor, listening to the doctor, and then finally, you know, allowing the doctor to take away their child, essentially. And now the father is, you know, we're trying to help him out in terms of the legal issues, and we will exonerate Mr. Yurko, who's a very articulate man, who's a very gentle and articulate spokesman for you know, the issue of vaccines now, because he's been damaged by it. His family has been ruined by it. And, it's
Dr.
tragic.
Maniotis, don't you think that going after the parents, it, to me, is the easy way out? In other words, they're providing protection by going after the parents and saying, you know, it's shaken baby syndrome, you know, you hurt your child, what did you do to your child?
Yeah.
Going after the parents instead of looking at what is the close proximity, what is the time factor between the symptoms that baby's exhibiting and vaccine.
Well, blaming the victim, it's called blaming the victim, which you're right, it's a distraction from the things, the questions that people ought to really be asking, you know, such as, has there been a placebo trial done such that no vaccine has been used on this population, and this new vaccine or whatever it be, like rotavirus, which causes, you know, intestinal perforations, Paul Offit's vaccine, you know, is there damage? And so the doctors don't know about it, and, you know, they're trained in medical school to believe in the in vaccinology and the Jennerian paradigm, with very little critical thinking involved. I mean, I taught at a medical school for quite a while, several medical schools, and I could see the medical students, you know, they're not too interested in critical thinking. They're interested in passing their qualifying exams so they can, you know, start practicing medicine. And I mean, I underline the word practice, because that's what they're doing on people when they vaccinate them. It's an experiment. It's a human experiment. That's not, you know, there's no oversight by committees. It's just assumed that injecting vile toxins, poisons, cells, all kinds of manner of metals that don't belong in an infant is a good thing to do, because you will prevent something from happening later if you do that. And so, you know, their argument, and, we're, you know, as I've said in other interviews I've had on this issue, I'm not reaching out to people who are converted at this point. I'm reaching out with respect and with all the informational armamentarium I can muster to reach out to those people, usually young parents who are, you know, too busy, they're trying to support their family, or too busy to investigate these things. I mean, that's why I feel it's my responsibility and the responsibility of others like me to provide as much information as objectively as I can, not talk about conspiracies, not talk about things like, you know, the evil intentions of these people, but just look at the data, look at all the centuries of data of vaccinology. It goes way back to ancient China, actually, but of course there was no clinical trials in ancient China when this was started, but it's an illustrative history to look at, because you can then begin to see the human underpinnings, as maybe psychology students would study in a college. You know, you see, like the Milgram experiment facet of the human mind, that there's this mentality that, you know, if other people are doing it, it's okay. I mean, that's a component of being a social primate. I mean, we have these long-standing trends to our behavior. And vaccination is based on a model of superstition, luck, and religion, to by and large, not science. All right.
Right.
The Greeks, for example, they have a tradition around Easter. You see all these old women in their black clothes, these widows cooking bread on Easter. And they call it somi. Somaki is bread in Greek. It means body, essentially body of Christ, all right? And they make these big round loaves of bread, and they put a quarter or a drachma in it, as it used to be before the euro and all. And they cut the thing up into slices, and they give it out to everybody at the party. And the person that gets the coin in it is supposedly lucky that year. I mean, that's what the ancient Chinese did with smallpox. They used to grind up smallpox, let it cure for a year or so. That means they just put it in a little vessel and let it dry out for a year, upon which, you know, it loses its virulence. And then they blow it up, they grind it and blow it up a baby's nose. And, of course, there was no, you know, way of studying it back then. The Persians used to do much the same in the Middle Ages. They'd exchange pox pustules for raisins and other fruits at the downtown city bazaars and things like that, suggesting, of course, that smallpox was not that strain was not so bad. I mean, you'd get the pox, but then you'd be immunized for life, and that's what they were hoping for. But it was a practice built on superstition that by exposing the organism a little bit to the poison that it will encounter in a real epidemic, that you're going to thereby protect the organism or attenuate the severity of the illness. And these issues are all still alive and well today. They're still debated. They're still heavily researched. And there are no hard and fast conclusions, you know, because we know so little about vaccines and their relationship to epidemics. But there are indeed, as you study the history, certain principles that seem to emerge. And by examining this history, one of the main principles that emerges is that the vaccination does not work to prevent epidemics, but it seems to promote them. If you look at enough vaccine trials going back centuries, you will see, I mean, even the British Parliament was led to stop compulsory vaccination in the 1800s because they were seeing huge outbreaks of smallpox in the vaccinated. And, you know, the Navy ships of the British Royal Empire and then in the United States and elsewhere, they would keep careful records of sailors who were revaccinated and vaccinated again and again for smallpox. And they'd see these huge outbreaks on ships. During the the Civil War, there were issues of changing the location of vaccination on the soldiers' arms to be more distal, that is further away from the body, so that when tissue rot would set in or some huge adverse reaction, they could amputate without taking the shoulder off of the soldiers. And you know, the doctors of the day wrote about this until the British Parliament said, enough is enough. We're not going to make parents pay 20 shillings if they don't vaccinate their children as a fine. But, you know, now in today's time, I mean, in New Jersey and elsewhere in the D.C. area, you know, these African-American parents that don't have their kids vaccinated are fined $500 a day, or they have to face jail time. So things have changed a lot, and things have changed very little in terms of this fear tactic of vaccination. And I'd like to talk more about that later, about this idea of herd immunity, because we've made some progress in this area recently with the concept of herd immunity. And we'll talk about that later.
You know, one of the things that I think, there's things that nag at me, questions that nag at me constantly about so much that's going on in today's times. And with this issue of vaccines, and one of the things when I wrote my articles, did my research and wrote, I had the people who are advocates for vaccines, and there are many of them, just came after me like a pack of wolves, which is fine, I can handle that. But my response to each and every one of them was, because I don't vaccinate, is how could my child possibly be a danger to yours? If you've got your child vaccinated and you believe that vaccine works and they're protected, what possible danger could my child present to yours?
Yeah, well, that, right.
Go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
That's a very germane point, and I've spoken recently about this publicly and also in interviews. about my so-called car wax vaccine idea. That
yes.
You know, if you believe that the vaccine is like car wax insofar as it will protect your child from rusting from a disease or your car from rusting in the Chicago winter here, then by all means, wax it. You know, get your kid vaccinated. But under no circumstances is your waxing your car going to influence my car, all right? Nor should you have any rights to force me to wax my car, all right? And it's just simple. This goes to the heart of this idea of herd immunity. Now the proponents of vaccination will say, well, you know, the vaccines don't always work. You know, it's only an 80% efficacy rate or this sort of thing. But it does attenuate disease. So you might get the illness, but it won't be so bad. Well, there's no evidence of that because, you know, we all have individual variable responses to illnesses and diseases depending on our, you know, our nutritional backgrounds, our genetic backgrounds, our family histories, et cetera. But you're absolutely right, Marty, that the concept of herd immunity is at the heart of this whole debate. People do not talk about it in a rational way, as far as I can tell, because if you believe that a procedure will help your child and he's going to be in the daycare with my child, well, that's fine. I mean, then my kid may get sick, but your kid's protected. So why should there be mandates? Why should there be browbeating? Mm-hmm. Why should there be prison sentences for African-American parents that opt not to have their kids experimented with a new vaccine, for example, et cetera?
Well, I know up here in Minnesota they're beginning, and I know they're doing this all over the country too, using what they are now referring to as a hospitalist, which is an on-board, on-staff physician or group of physicians who supposedly provide 24-hour inpatient care. Some of them may have a clinic elsewhere. Most of them don't. They've contracted with the hospital. And it says that what they do is they're there to make sure that you have one-on-one with a physician and that you get all necessary care, treatment, therapies, medications, and so on. So digging further into that, what I found was basically they've contracted to the hospital, and the hospitalist's job is to make sure that absolutely every therapy, treatment, medication that could be possibly applied to your diagnosis is.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't meet the profit margin, then they create another diagnosis. Now, I bring this up because what they're doing with, and we've got many parents up here now who just, they've gotten the news on vaccines and they will not let them vaccinate their newborns with Hep B. Mm-hmm. And they refuse to have them get childhood immunizations. Now, in my efforts to collect data on that, how many of your kids have had like chickenpox, measles, how many of them have gotten sick, how many of you have parents have children who have any sort of autism, maybe Asperger's symptoms, you know, whatever it is. Do we have learning disabilities, or is your child not progressing like it should? And in the group that's not vaccinated, the answer is across the board, they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Talking with parents who've had their children vaccinated, I start hearing these stories, but this happened, but that happened. And you know what I'm saying? You start hearing this, but, and I don't know what's wrong. And he got the vaccination, and now he isn't sitting up anymore, and he doesn't respond. Now, here's the thing. These parents who are refusing to vaccinate, they're really threatening and intimidating them. They're threatening to take their children from them, claiming they are neglectful parents and not capable of care. And now we have, they want to bring this system in up here, where a pregnant woman is subjected to psychiatric examination to see if she's fit to bring her baby home. And one of the criteria is, will you vaccinate?
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing always leads into the other. But I've noticed that this system being put in place, this hospitalist system being put in place, it seems to be the strong arm, the enforcer here, because when they come into the picture, your primary care physician is no longer in control of your case.
Right. They can call the Department of Child and Family Services. I've been involved in a number of cases that way where the child has actually been placed in foster care. Or in one case just recently last week that happened, the child was removed from the mother's custody an hour or several hours after she delivered, and when she refused to vaccinate, and she was only allowed to come in the hospital to breastfeed at certain times of day. I mean, this is how bad it's getting, and it even goes worse than that. GlaxoSmithKline, with their hexavalent vaccine now, is trying to vaccinate fetuses. But you know, long before they have maternal antibodies and immunity, they're trying to inject the fetus in the womb.
Talk about that, please. I just came across that, Dr. Menios. I just came across. This is so barbaric to me.
Yeah, well, it's barbaric, but it's also, in their viewpoint, a eugenic issue. And you know, I've spoken about that recently, but it bears repeating that if we can. If we can bioengineer ourselves against epidemics and this sort of thing, believing that the vaccine, like car wax, will protect our children, then it's irrational for you, a non-vaccinator, to refuse, because we are engineering society here have a certain acquired immunity due to human intervention that wouldn't normally be there. But it's a false premise. I mean, especially, again, if you look at the history, because epidemics caused by humans are predictable. They are very predictable. The more and more you study them, to the extent that vaccine campaigns and epidemics have been frequently associated. Evidence from the 1800s in The Lancet and from elsewhere, and more in modern journals, more and more groups are coming out showing, as in I think your neck of the woods in Minnesota, that the Mayo Clinic showed that there was a 3 times greater hospitalization rate amongst vaccinated kids, not to mention a far greater asthma rate amongst these children than in the non-vaccinated. Now, that's not a big difference, threefold, but going back to the polio era, it was 300-fold more acute flaccid paralysis in places like Massachusetts, 15-fold in Idaho, and 3-fold again in California of paralysis, until they discovered here in Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago that kids were becoming paralyzed in the buttock or in the arm in which they were vaccinated. And that sounded the alarm bells weeks after the Salk vaccine was first released in 1955, and then they stopped it right away. So, again, epidemics can be predicted. You just follow where the vaccines are being given, and that's where you'll see the biggest. I mean, I was doing dishes tonight, believe it or not, and on NPR, there was just a huge campaign of college campus kids being rounded up and vaccinated with teams of doctors, and they were making allusion to it was a military-like operation with teams of 15 or so health care providers vaccinating 9,000 college students in a single day, and they're patting themselves on the back. But if you look around you, all you hear is, a governor of New York and Massachusetts are now calling a state of emergency, an epidemic emergency. Well, that's because they're delivering, a new vaccine that is spreading the illness, all right? So many people are getting vaccinated, and they've shown in tissue culture dishes in laboratories that the so-called live virus is still potent for 28 days after you receive the flu mist, and you spread it all over the place. And instead of stopping the ridiculous idea of vaccinating everybody, they're handing Lysol to these special student monitors going around cleaning up doorknobs and telling everybody to sneeze into their arm. Well, if the vaccine works, if it has any efficacy whatsoever, how come there is so much illness?
Yes.
And we don't have to go too far. I mean, the 76 swine flu was just a travesty, with Gerald Ford getting injected on TV, and it was all because of a soldier had a heat stroke, and it had nothing to do with any kind of swine flu. And, immediately they declared 500 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, and I'm dealing with a case like that right now, which is just horrendous. I've never seen Guillain-Barré with my own eyes before, and, oh, my God, it's a horrible affliction of paralysis, inability to speak, et cetera.
Yeah,
and it was on 60 Minutes. I mean, on my website, I think it's very close in the beginning of one of the documents called the analysis of an FDA document, the chronicling of David Sensor, who was head of the CDC, and his pushing through the 76 swine flu vaccine without a single test being done, because they gave 50 million injections of a lot that had not been tested on animals or on anything else. And that's the one that was immediately stopped or halted. You can see that with every vaccine that comes along. Offit's vaccines, the guy that says we should inject our infants with 10,000 antigens, his vaccines caused intestinal perforations. Now, that's a pretty serious condition, you know. And
well, he just came out with a new version of that, didn't he? That he
yes,
got
he
a perfect achievement at Christmas.
Which
you
brings
know,
me to another
about...
issue. If you want to really talk
oh.
about it now, I'd like to get it you know,
sure.
early in the program, in case people have other things to do. But yeah, Paul Offit recently wrote a position statement on philosophical and religious exemptions of vaccines, and I read it and I fell off my chair, because he says, well, we should ban or make illegal philosophical exemptions. And this came in the heels of the California 2009 bill, where they force now people claiming a religious or philosophical exemption to get an okay note from their doctor. So, you know, they're making it more difficult to, you know, make your own personal health choices in this life. But Offit wrote, philosophical exemptions should be outlawed or illegal because... well, the Greeks invented philosophy, sort of, and, you know, that was 2,000 years ago, and, you know, we have science now. I mean, we are in the age of science, and vaccination is a scientific, evidence-based procedure. And I agree. We do live in an age of science now that we didn't have at the time of Ptolemy and Aristotle. And then he says, or he has the gall to say, you know, we should make illegal religious exemptions, too, because, well... You know the great religions of the world were also starting up around 1,000 years ago, and we live in an age of science. Again, you know, Dr. Offit is right. We do live in an age of science, or we should at least be directed by a scientific inquiry. And in both cases, I agree. We should live in an age of science, but under no circumstances has any vaccine, especially the new modern schedule of 29 or so vaccines and antigens given to children, been scientifically tested. So I'm proposing to the Illinois legislature, I'm proposing to the Illinois Department of Public Health, the Age of Autism, all kinds of organizations I work with, that we should have a new exemption called the scientific exemption. That is for those people that... want to say, you know, show me the scientific evidence of a single vaccine that's ever been scientifically tested to date. And I'm going back to the very beginning of vaccinology. There has been not one that has completed any kind of experimental test that you would consider being scientifically sound. So I'm proposing to you, to the world, a new exemption called the scientific exemption on the heels of Paul Offit's position statement.
Dr. Maniotis, I can see by the phone number here, a close friend of mine here in Minnesota has called in, and she had gotten the flu vaccine here in the 80s and suffered from, well, we pronounce it Guillain-Barré. And Diane, turn your sound down on your...
Okay.
Yeah, because
okay.
you can't. And Dr. Maniotis, this is Diane Muehlbauer, and she has firsthand experience with this Guillain-Barré as a result of a vaccine.
Hi, Diane.
So go ahead, Diane.
Hi, Doctor. Yeah, I got a flu vaccine in 1987, and in a couple weeks I had I call it like an explosion, but something in the back of my head, two of them. And then by morning... I was feeling sick and started aching. I thought I had the flu.
Mm.
Okay. And then, and it kept getting worse. My muscles got worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started seeing double.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I saw there were five Mayo doctors that came down here, and nobody really knew what I had. A couple thought I had some kind of chemical poisoning, and so in the process, I was getting worse,
yep.
you know. So I found a neurologist in town here that I went to, and he looked in my eyes and felt the back of my neck and put me in the hospital and did a spinal tap.
Mm-hmm.
And came in that night and told me I had Guillain-Barré.
Mm-hmm.
He had told me it was from the flu shot.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else told me that prior to that, but let's see. I think I went in on a Friday, and by Monday I couldn't walk at all or use my arms.
How long did that last?
2 years.
You see, the gentleman I'm working with right now, he's been in a state of, we thought it was dystonia, but we just found out this morning it was Guillain-Barré syndrome, because he tests positive for the so-called GQ1D protein, and he's got all of the telltale signs, the face that doesn't smile, etc. But he's beginning to talk now, but it's taken him a year, and it may take a full other year. I was just asking you for your experience, how long it took to have some kind of, alleviation of your vaccine damage, because he had a tetanus vaccine last November. And anyway, we've been, watching him day and night every day this last year, because he's been in some very precarious situations, and he's got a G tube now, and he can't talk very well, if at all. He can mumble a few words here and there, but he can't cannot walk. And he's
well.
Not
what
really,
I was
yeah.
Yeah, what I was told was that it's fatal, and what they do is they put you on life support.
Yeah.
And I got 10,000 milligrams of B12 a day, every
yeah.
day.
Yeah. Did anybody suggest infusing massive doses of C, because the responsible physicians and scientists of the 1950s and 60s learned about that with so-called polio and a flaccid paralysis. They could reverse symptoms in 72 hours, but only with 50 gram or greater infusions three times a week, and the vitamin B that you mentioned. We've got the guy on the vitamin B, but and the C, but now, and we're going to
I don't
see.
Know if he did or not. He may mm-hmm. have. I don't remember that. And I remember him coming in every night checking my lungs. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, he's on life support too, just like you said.
Yeah, and when I was there, there's no age factor, that's for sure, because
no.
there was I was the seventh one in Minnesota to show up with it, and there was a 7-year-old boy in Brainerd, and there was I believe he was a cook here at one of the fancy restaurants. And even after I left, and my neurologist, actually, I left before I should have, but I had 3 children at home to raise, and he set me up at home with all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an aide coming in, but I had weak spells for years.
How long ago did this happen, did you say? Sorry.
In 87.
In 87, and do you still suffer from it today?
Well, first I took B12 shots for, oh my God, I don't know, 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was taking the liquid, and I would get these weak spells for like 3-4 days where
mm-hmm.
I just couldn't do anything till they'd pass. And then I have
paralysis?
Some nerve damage.
Yeah,
I can't really.
Yeah.
Huh?
There was nerve damage.
Well, yeah, I can't. Even today, sometimes I can fall easy, or if I try to run, or
mm-hmm.
Therapy was fun, I'll tell you. Once these nerves start coming back,
mm-hmm.
that was painful.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's so anyway. When I first saw this neurologist and had gone in his office, and he told me he was looking for 2 things. The Guillain-Barré or MS,
mm-hmm.
and here it was from the shot.
Mm-hmm.
So, from what I understand, when you have this, they said it could come back. Have you heard of anything like that?
No, I'm pretty new to the topic myself right now, because we've been dealing with this individual who's got extremely bad situation of Guillain-Barré, and he you know, he's, like you said, he's been on life support on and off. He gets better, and then he then goes down again. But yet, you know, he's had some pretty consistent improvement over the last 2 or 3 months now for the first time in a year. And now that we have a firm diagnosis, we can then go about attacking the problem a little bit more directly than, you know, instead of guessing we thought it was Lyme disease at first. We thought it was HIV infection at first. And we've eliminated all these things. And now the protein came back, this new test for Guillain-Barré that seems to be relatively, descriptive of the syndrome. We'll see what we can do. But, my heart goes out to you, Diane. I believe it was a woman named Diane that Mike Wallace interviewed on that 1977 or 78 60 Minutes with, the head of the CDC, David Sensor, who put that swine flu vaccine out there because one soldier had a heat stroke. And the woman named Diane that had paralysis and her husband and she were interviewed, and it was immediately halted, just like every vaccine I've ever studied the history of, you know.
Yeah, we have a teacher in town, too, that I've been trying to get a hold of. She contracted it, too, and even today, I think it's been 3 years, still has problems, and now a young girl in the elementary school,
mm-hmm.
I think she was 8 or 9, she's got it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that is a result of the vaccine and confined to the vaccine? Is it something that's contagious?
No.
I mean, that's what I was wondering, because I assume that that's the next leap they're going to make. Well, it must be some new virus or something we didn't know, and you're passing it to people. Diane, did you have any more questions or comments for Dr. Maniotis?
Oh, I don't think right now, but I've been listening to him, and it was really interesting.
I have one for you, Diane. Did you receive compensation from the vaccine compensation program?
No. You know what?
And why not?
I don't know. I guess back at that time, I didn't know I could do anything, and they weren't really saying too much, only that it was only the one doctor, I think, that had mentioned, did you just get a flu shot? And I said, yeah. And
mm-hmm. Well, you were fortunate to have a doctor that was able to see that, because most doctors
up front, yes.
Yeah, would obfuscate and say, there's no way a vaccine could cause such a thing. But it's known now, there's no question that vaccines harm individuals such as yourself.
As years went by, doctor, then I see that now Guillain-Barré is a side effect of the flu shot, but it took 20 years before they put that out there.
Yeah, it's a side effect of a lot of different medical interventions, but principally vaccination has been the biggest offender that we know of, other than certain heavy drugs and things such as anesthesia and operations and certain bacterial infections of the gut and elsewhere in the lungs.
I had an Army doctor that gave my daughter at 10 months old a smallpox vaccination. She went into that night into convulsions, 105 fever.
Oh,
they had to throw her in ice. Mm-hmm. Then they'd send her home. She'd go back into convulsions. We went through that for 3 weeks. She almost died.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the end of that there. And then when I got this flu shot, too, they said, that one doctor said, you must have been vaccinated with a dead virus or something in school. And, I'll tell you.
Dr. Maniotis, about that time on PBS, mm-hmm. this dead virus thing, PBS here, and it's been about 10 years ago, did a documentary that they claim they can't find now, but it was about up here in the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and I believe Iowa, that what they did was they gave out free milk. I can remember this in elementary school. They gave out free milk. Mm-hmm. And you could have all the milk you wanted. And come to find out, they had salted it with all sorts of live and dead viruses and bacteria and whatever they could come up with. Mm-hmm. And then they sat back and for years watched to see how many of us got sick How many of us didn't? And if we got sick, what did we get sick with? Where are we at now? And they did this huge documentary. I tried and tried to get a copy of that. PBS said, yeah, they remembered airing it, but no, they didn't know what happened to it. Mm-hmm. But they did that to in elementary schools all up across here.
I remember that, Marty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not new either to, you know, the so-called science of vaccinology. They, during the Hep B era, you know, admission for down kids and mentally retarded children in certain institutions was predicated with the command and the mandate that they receive, you know, a vaccine or that, you know, they are experimented on by a live or attenuated viral prep of some sort. So this has been going on for a long time. It's human experimentation of the worst kind. Baruch Blumberg, the so-called discoverer of the HBS AG antigen said to be, you know, hepatitis B surface antigen, did that sort of thing and on prisoners, on retarded children. And, you know, this brings up another point that, you know, it's people that are, you know, deemed to be not so important members of our society that are typically experimented on. But when, like David Sensor does it to the American population, 50 million people are vaccinated, and he's then thrown out of the CDC. He just goes to industry and gets a job there, and where, you know, mm-hmm. where he continues his mayhem, much like Paul Offit, for example.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's a very Offit. I think is a very dangerous man. I don't know why anybody takes him seriously in anything. He's been caught in so much crap; it's not funny, and they just keep rolling on with him. And but I guess when you're evil to the bone.
Well,
but,
you don't have to go too far. For example, with mercury, the mercury issue in vaccines. I mean, Paul Forson was convicted a few years ago of 11 counts of money laundering. He was the one responsible for the two reports that in the Danish study, so-called Danish study, that showed that kids receiving the mercury in the vaccines were just as likely to be sick as non-vaccinated kids, and they fudged the data. And these are the kinds of people who are placed at the helm of these campaigns for one reason or another. And, you know, if you look into their histories a little bit, you can begin to see that these people aren't, you know, just like your next-door neighbors. Many of them, after they're caught fudging data or, you know, money laundering and or belonging to two institutions when that's illegal and things like that, as Thorsten was, you know, you find out that their behaviors that they're caught for, one of the former proponents of the swine flu a few years ago was allegedly caught with, you know, kids in a compromising situation in her home and things like that, and her boyfriend. And, you know, we go back to the prion days with D. Carlton Gajdacek, the so-called father of the prion diseases, Scrapie and Creutzfeldt-Jakob and those the other ones. And, you know, he pled guilty to child sexual abuse and things like that. These people are extremely emotionally disturbed in many cases, who are able to, you know, graduate from medical school under the somewhat impossible standards that are thrown before human beings to try to become doctors, and they do quite well. But there are reasons, I'm finding out more and more, that these people have, you know, as a parent myself of three kids, I mean, they aren't the kind of people you would really want to trust your children or anyone else in your family to, you know.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And don't you find, Dr. Maniotis, that this is prevalent, it seems, everywhere? Someone had said at one point that, there's more of this than there ever was. No, I don't think there is. It's just that now we find out about it. Before they could keep it secret, but now we find out about it.
Yep.
And so it through exposure, it seems like there's more of it.
Right.
And there possibly is. Up here in Minnesota, it's just an everyday routine. The pedophilia up here is so pervasive in everything. It's well known, but actually nothing's ever really done about it. And but you really want to watch your kids.
Well,
Diane, did you have...
Oh, sorry.
Oh,
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, Marty, you're right on that one because I was in law enforcement for 20 years, and I'll tell you, there's a lot going on that people don't realize. We need more awareness, for one thing, on this issue.
Yeah.
But these people frighten me when they get into these positions of power. And I can't remember, I'm thinking it was in the 50s or 60s that big shot psychiatrist up there in Canada subjected all those children to these massive, they were all orphans, to these massive doses of x-rays. And they had a trial, and he got in a little bit of trouble, and away he went. Well, it came out later on that far more was going on than x-ray. But see, I don't understand, doctor, I don't understand when you have the potential to do so much good, why do you do so much harm?
Let me tell you a quick story, a historical story. It just goes back a few years, all right? It deals with my cancer realm and things like that. It's a good question, Marty. Why if they're, trained to, try to help humanity, why does it end up being such a mess? Well, take the case of Chester Southam, S-O-U-T-H-A-M, I believe is the way you spell his name. But he was a doctor at Sloan Kettering during the 1950s, and HeLa cells had just been first isolated, Helen Lane cells from an African-American woman in Baltimore. And he went ahead and injected them into 80 prisoners' arms in Ohio, 600 women gynecology patients at Sloan Kettering, and 40 aged and very morbidly ill Jewish folks at the Chronic Jewish Disease Hospital in Brooklyn. And his rationale was, since he was on the front lines of seeing patients every day, they wanted to know what would happen if he needle stuck, or they needle stuck themselves with a syringe that had been in a cancer patient. So they decided to inject live cervical cancer cells under 600 women's arms, and they put a little black dot where they did it. And they,
oh my God!
They did it to the sick Jewish people, and also the 80 prisoners or so in Ohio. And they discovered, to everybody's surprise, that in every case the tumor cells were rejected. And he wanted to develop the test into an assay for immune suppression and cancer, because the aged sick people took the longest to reject their cancers, but and the prisoners took the shortest, in the women in Sloan Kettering. But he was then reprimanded slightly because three of his students, who happened to be Jewish doctors at the Chronic Disease Hospital, reported him. A year later, after his reprimand, and they stopped the stopping of these three trials, I mean, he was then elected vice president of the American Cancer Society, all right?
Oh, God.
So, anyway, I mean, these kinds of stories can be told, over and over again, and they've happened over and over again. It's interesting. It's interesting because if you read a book by Paul Dequeue, who wrote the famous book Virus Hunters, I think it was, or Microbe Hunters, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
He also wrote a book that's not so well read. It's called Life with Doctors, in which he describes a Dr. Tom Spies, S-P-I-E-S, who under FDR were charged with erecting the public health system in this country. FDR wasn't too interested because he wanted to spend the money on bombs, planes, and bullets for the upcoming Second World War. But nevertheless, Spies got a lot of our infrastructure in place for clean water, food for kids that was, as wholesome as possible. And this is when we see the various epidemic diseases declining in the early part of the century, is when infrastructure and water systems and treatment plants are being erected all over the country. And why it is that the medical establishment and the pharmaceutical establishment cannot embrace that, because they have children also. I keep reminding them of that.
Yes.
They have children, and their children are going to have children. So don't you want to live in a culture and a society that looks at the data rationally instead of hysterically? And tries to change people's behavior based on all the evidence that we have, that both good and bad, against these medical interventions. I mean, I would think that they do. So I think there is a great incentive to keep trying to educate people, to have more and more discussions. As you said, you know, Marty, it's not so much that this hasn't happened in the past. I mean, there's been huge debates. As I mentioned, Parliament in Britain, they outlawed mandatory compulsory vaccines after the smallpox was breaking out because of the Jennerian cowpox vaccine crusades at the time. I mean, the rates of smallpox just shot through the roof. So eventually it's going to work. And I keep reminding people of this because, you know, we are one group of people. I mean, human beings are, I guess, are kind of fortunate amongst the primates because we're all one species. You know, we are all able to breed with one another and produce children. And this idea that there are, you know, less desirable people or more desirable people or a need for a eugenic sculpting of humanity is ridiculous, because we are all, with our diversity, the strongest possible defense there is against epidemics. I mean, just take the two great plagues that happened in Europe. They happened about 313 years apart. There was no vaccine for plague back then. Nobody could predict that plague would hit exactly 313 years apart and have huge epidemic consequences. And so a vaccine had nothing to do with those occurrences. But in modern times, we do have records, we do keep records, and we do have some understanding of the dynamics of illness and how to deal with these epidemics because of people who have, you know, especially very responsible doctors who have studied the human body as a system instead of as a machine that needs to be oiled here and there or waxed from time to time with a vaccine or whatever. Instead, when people get sick, they let the body, this marvelous dynamic system, fix itself, and they just try to supply it with the raw materials, the environment of rest or fluids, and you know, not eating if you're purging, because you know you don't want the body to spend extra resources on digestion when you're trying to rid it of a pathogen of some sort, and it'll do that. It's a marvelous system of nature.
Well, you know, I think years ago, not knowing anything at all, I thought, you know, the vaccines had to be a good idea. And I think what was a really wake-up light bulb moment for me was actually seeing the ingredients, the metals, chemicals, human diploid cells, DNA strands of other human beings in those vaccines. And looking at that, last year when they came out with the flu vaccine and they were pushing everybody to get it, and I started carrying in my purse copies of what was in that vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm at my doctor's office, and when I went to leave, the receptionist said to me, "Did you get your flu vaccine?" I said, "No." And she says, "Well, we can give it to you right now." I said, "No, you can't." And she says, "Well, aren't you going to get one?" And I said, "No." There's people sitting in the waiting room. And this woman said, "Well, we got ours." And she said, "You could infect us." I said, "Well, I thought you said the vaccine worked. Isn't that why you got it? How could I possibly infect you?"
Mm-hmm.
And so I pulled out copies of what was in this vaccine and was handing them out. I said, "Here is what they shot you full of." And I said, "Now you people are a danger to everyone around you."
Mm-hmm.
And I handed one to the receptionist. And she went, "What's this supposed to mean?" I said, "It means that that's what they put in your body. And if you think this was a good idea, you've got that shot laying there with my name on it. Take mine. Get a double dose. That way you'll be double protected." And, of course, they don't like that. But this was my biggest weapon against people screaming about these vaccines. And could you talk a little bit about that? What's in them? When you look at this list of chemicals,
Yeah,
and
sure.
Metals. And how in the hell could this possibly keep you from getting sick?
Well, you got to appreciate the vaccination began with a history of the infusion of lymph or pus, cellular materials, associated microbes, toxins, and other substances into the human body that are foreign. And they bypass mucosal immunity, which is a very important defense of the body, the nostrils and the mouth and the anus and the sexual entry points are all protected by a wonderful, wonderful system. And so by, you know, injecting them directly into the bloodstream, these pus and other things, you are bypassing that which has taken, you know, 3 billion years to perfect, you know. And the arrogance of these people to think that a so-called doctor like Jenner, who wasn't really a doctor, who killed his son and his son's best friend with his first vaccines, and his idea of cowpox protecting from smallpox, even though it was then discovered that the milkmaids were actually giving the cow udders these little pustules and not the other way around, perhaps, is ridiculous, all right? From a tissue grafting point of view, and that's what blood is a tissue. It's a soluble tissue. It's not like the tissue in your brain, but it's soluble. Inoculation was practiced, as I mentioned, in Persia and elsewhere as an operation where the surface of the body was injured with needles or lancets, and foreign pus from pox or perhaps other eruptions similar to pox was made to have contact directly to the bloodstream, or you know, in nowadays with flu mist or the mucous membranes or the nose, in the case of the Chinese, as I mentioned, with their smallpox blowing up the nose of infants. This practice suggests, moreover, that the smallpox of that era, as I mentioned, was not particularly frightening with respect to its virulence, although there are reports that natural epidemics carried off 50% of the population during small outbreaks. And you can read that in Cruikshank's History and Pathology of Vaccination, for example. I mean, in this context, there was an intense discussion regarding whether to use year-old pus, which is an important issue, that's dried out from a previous bout of illness, versus obtaining material directly from an ill person. And Pasteur was the one that figured this out, and it's still one of the major problems of vaccines today, and that is, how do you make a protective agent that will, you know, protect against all strains, no matter how virulent they may be or how benign they may be, and at the same time not give the illness to that those whom you are vaccinating, bypassing mucosal immunity. And Pasteur wrestled with that, with rabies, and came up with this drying out of spinal cords of infected rabbits and then injected those into the dogs, and then he finally got some sort of protection. But nevertheless, the application of aged versus fresh lymph, depending on how long it's been sitting on a shelf, from a like a smallpox probably made quite a difference in the severity of the inoculated disease. That's why I believe what they're doing in England right now with their 9 million doses given to children of this flu mist is creating the flu epidemic. And, in fact, we've heard recent reports about why, you know, whooping cough is at the greatest levels it's ever been in Washington State and Seattle, in Washington State and Oregon and California right now. 50 years. I mean, and these are amongst 100% vaccinated populations. And what you hear the news pundits saying is, well, not enough people are being vaccinated. Again, going back to this car wax analogy and what you mentioned, Marty, and the absurdity of worrying about people who aren't vaccinated if you believe in the vaccine. Well, the real problem is that the vaccine doesn't work, and so the people are going to get sick anyway. They're going to get sick at a greater rate. And that's why. I mean, and you ask about these adulterants, the additives, or what are called adjuvants. Now, I'll just speak on that briefly. What adjuvants are, such as aluminum, such as squalene, and others, they efficiently do what they're designed to do, and that is they have a massive upregulation of an immune response. And the reason they are used in vaccines is because the material that is supposed to evoke immunity doesn't evoke immunity. So, again, everything you look at with vaccines is sort of hedging. It's, all right, the virus put in the vaccine is not evoking immunity, so now we're going to put in a cholesterol precursor such as squalene, which many of us now attribute as the causal reason for the Gulf War syndrome in many cases and in other morbid conditions. The reason we do that is because if you write a grant in a laboratory, if you're a biologist, you know, and you want to study fascitis or something like that, the destruction of muscles in rats, or if you want to study arthritis, you know what you use? You use squalene because it can reliably induce these in rodents, all right, these syndromes. So why would you put it in a human vaccine? Well, because it does very efficiently what it's supposed to do. It has a massive upregulation of neutrophils and macrophage responses at the site of injection and throughout the body to such an extent in many cases that it causes what we call ischemia. Ischemia is the, you know, the lack of oxygen to tissues because the blood vessels get clogged up with this huge artificially induced immune response, which is made to you know, dog the heels of the antigen in the vaccine that's supposed to protect you from the illness, because the antigen in the vaccine doesn't protect you from the illness. So they're hoping and hedging that by artificially ramping up with squalene or aluminum the immune system, that you will then have a more vigorous response when the time comes to, you know, be exposed to a pathogen. It's all nonsense. It doesn't make any sense from a biological point of view, a rational point of view, an economic point of view, if you will. I mean, it's ridiculous how, you know, the soldiers have been experimented on with such things as squalene and their anthrax vaccines, for example, which Pasteur made 200 years, you know, almost 200 years ago now.
Yeah, but we've weaponized anthrax now.
Well, I know.
They've got that new vaccine come out, and they've got that new that they want to test on infants and toddlers.
Well, I know. I mean, we weaponized it to protect ourselves from postmen in Washington during 9/11 and things like that.
Yeah, right.
And they only killed five of them. They only killed five of them, though. You know, they're quite a vital weapon, I might add. You know,
I got to get going, but it was nice talking to you, Doctor.
Nice meeting you, Diana, and good luck to you. And I hope that you know that your issues are behind you now.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Thanks, Marty, and I'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks for calling.
Bye.
Yeah,
I'd like to say one more thing if I could about squalene, and that was that in one of the military experiments done a few years ago, we found out that, one soldier, for example, who was being accused of infecting someone with HIV and thereby was facing criminal prosecution, he had 49 vaccines, about 12 different flu vaccines, OPV, oral polio, and yellow fever and all these other vaccines. But can you imagine 49 vaccines in a space of 3 years? And, you know, these people don't appreciate that going to a little bit of the biology of this, not just the adjuvants or adulterants such as squalene, but the biology itself, it must be, I mean, I can't let the show go by without saying that, aluminum is found 8 years in the arms of cadavers at the site of vaccination. So it never, you know, really is dispersed, which raises issues of Alzheimer's issues and things like that. Not to mention mercury. All right, mercury collects in the large gut, and people have shown that over and over again. It stays there.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to put, 247 times the EPA limit of neurotoxin into an infant, be my guest and, you know, go wax your infant. But please don't tell me to wax mine.
Yeah.
The other adulterants, though, are of interest, too, because, some of them, we don't even appreciate what they are doing. I mean, they have not been studied yet. They really have not. If you look carefully at the literature, nobody has really done a careful study on a particular vaccine, and whenever they do, or when someone tries to, such as they did on the monkeys up in Seattle, that Andrew Wakefield was vilified and tarred and feathered for, reporting his study in England, and he lost his job, and then he came here, and he lost his license here and all that. But, you know, and then they inject some 20-some monkeys, and, you know, several of them have damage. I mean, that's reason enough to evoke the precautionary principle. That is to say that until we have a better grasp of the data, we should err on the side of caution. And the caution is not that this magical vaccine will protect you or your children or your loved ones. The cautionary principle is that these medical interventions are akin to doing a tissue transplant, all right? You're infusing foreign substances into the body that don't belong there, bypassing mucosal immunity. And this is not controversial. Even, I mean, that's why they make flu mist. That's why they're now looking more and more at live preparations that are administered into mucosal membranes. So at least they are presented to the body the way they would be otherwise. But nevertheless, there's no evidence whatsoever that any of these interventions due to vaccines have protected anyone at any time. In fact, if you read the accounts of the Great Flu, so-called Great Spanish Flu, which was really not from Spain, but was blamed on the Spanish because we didn't like them at the time, you know, you find, you know, reports of people who were not vaccinated because that's when they just started compulsory vaccination in the military in 1911, and it continued through the next few years until we had one of the biggest, sickest populations of people on the planet. It's called the Great Flu, all right? And, you know, many people have attributed that to the vaccination programs that began at military bases that affected people in the prime of life, and no illness is ever known to do that naturally. It culls back infants and it culls back old people, but during the great so-called influenza of the 1918 era, 1919, most of the people who were affected were, you know, in their 20s and 30s. They were in the military, and there was huge morbidity written down and chronicled by people like Eleanor Bean, who actually cared for the sick, who didn't get sick themselves, oddly enough, because they weren't vaccinated. And,
wow.
You know, it goes on and on and on. I mean, there's so many examples. Going into the 30s, for example, another flu epidemic, it caused yellow fever. Vaccines do a number of things, you know. In most human beings, we've discovered, they're like a shot filled with water. They don't do anything, all right? They don't protect. They don't harm. And, you know, you can live life perfectly well with a bunch of things infused in your body, and your body will get rid of it. But in many cases, as in Diane's case, just called, we know that vaccines harm individuals. We have vaccine-damaged courts. We have the VAERS reporting system. You know, it hurts individuals. Question is, what is it doing to populations? And, you know, in many cases, vaccines induce epidemics of things that they're not even associated with, such as leprosy. I mean, the great Hawaiian colonies of leper colonies was primarily due to the smallpox vaccine. On the California military bases, the syphilis outbreaks were due to, again, smallpox vaccines. So vaccines cause diseases they're not even associated with, all right? Or they do nothing like a shot filled with water. Or they harm individuals. But the big question is, what are we doing to a, as you started the show, I thought aptly pointing out, what are we doing to a population or a generation of children now whose autism rate is 1 in 88 or so for boys? And, you know, developmental delays, autism spectrum disorder, Asperger's and all that. Why is it so prevalent today? And it's not just reporting, and it's not genetics. I mean, the National Institutes of Health and all of the reductionists, they like to look at genes or evoke genes for explanations. Oh, there must be funny genes in these kids that are afflicted. But you don't have to go to genes to find the affliction, because the record of history is legion with whole populations of people that were damaged or injured by a vaccine, one vaccine program or another. I mean, they are the greatest assault against the human being that I can think of, other than perhaps nuclear warfare.
I think, very extraordinarily dangerous, and I don't think he even realizes how malignant he is Bill Gates. And I was upset to learn that here in the last year he gave $500 million to vaccinate children in Africa. And I do know from, I've been a political writer for many, many years. I'm renowned for my resourcing and documentation. And what I had found was that there is a clear intent. They wanted it to happen by 2025 to have an absolute reduction of 80% of the indigenous population in Africa, because it is such a mineral resource asset rich continent, and these people are getting in the way. And I've watched just over my lifetime as they have tried to starve these people, they have tried to murder these people, they have run them off their land, they have killed them at every opportunity.
No, they accuse them of having AIDS because they work in the mines and they have silicosis and other diseases. That was Harvard School AIDS initiative under Maurice Templesman, who was an economic hitman behind the HIV AIDS scares in Africa, were just getting by with not giving the workers masks so they could be safe in the mines. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a huge, huge wealth of resources there. But you mentioned Bill Gates, and I'd like to say something about that, because it's I've gotten so many questions about this quote of his in recent weeks by many, many people. they quote Bill Gates as saying, you know, vaccines will reduce population. There's this little quote that he said in the speech he gave. But I interpret that, you know, just to be fair and to reach out to the proponents of vaccines and the people who watch Bill Gates go in front of a TED audience and release a bunch of malarial mosquitoes he claims out of a jar into the audience just to scare the hell out of the audience. You know, Bill Gates is speaking in a sense factually when he says that vaccination or some kind of practice like it has a potential of reducing population because there's not going to be the infant mortality. They don't finish the sentence for Mr. Gates. And believe me, I'm no fan of Mr. Gates because he's got men on his staff that who's like Seth Kalikman, whose life mission right now is to destroy people like me and our professions, our jobs, and all that. But you have to give him credit for the idea that, yes, I mean, if we do support infrastructure, however, not vaccines, but if we give the kids a substance known as Plumpy Nut, which is a salt and peanut butter mixture, you reduce infant mortality enormously, you know, and the Doctors Without Borders are finding this to be the case. There was a big story on it, and I think Anderson Cooper did it, showing the poorest country in Africa, Niger, how these Doctors Without Borders were turning around the because you can store it, the stuff without refrigeration, and the kids love it. It tastes good, you know, and it provides them with the essential proteins they need to establish immunity. I mean, one of the quickest ways of having someone acquire AIDS is not through a virus or through sex. It's through starvation. And in about 8 to 12 days, the T cells crash, and they can be brought back through proper nutrition. So these poor people don't have an immune system that functions very well to begin with. And you're absolutely right. Africa is a testing ground for colonialism. It has been since the days of slavery and continues to be to this very day. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Well, Gates, that statement, that quote from him, his rationale for that was that they have a lot of children because they expect to lose children, so they keep having kids. And, you know, that almost makes sense. But having tracked this man and his comments and statements, and I swear he alternates, Dr. Maniotis, I swear this man walks a fine line between idiot and genius. I swear he does.
Well,
but I think he is a very malignant man. And this vaccine campaign of his is not to save children of the world. And his intent is, I believe, to reduce the population, but only select populations. And his answer now to this is he's helping to develop these aerosol sprays, because he said the idea that anybody should be able to refuse a vaccine is just unforgivable. So based on the fact that you inhale this, and like you're talking about them, you know, putting this pox up these babies' noses and everything, and we've come out now with the nasal mist for the flu, isn't that handy? And But this nasal mist is the preliminary, I believe, in my inexperience and lack of knowledge, to the aerosol
spray. You're right.
Yes. And this is what he wants to do. So you'll get vaccinated whether you like it or you don't. It won't be a question of you have a philosophical objection or religious objection.
Mm-hmm.
It will be, if you breathe, you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on that point, he is just as dangerous as Offit is. And there again, here's a man with the potential to do a tremendous amount of good, and he knows it.
Mm-hmm.
He knows it. And he paints what he's doing as though it's a good deed. It's humanitarian. I'm just trying to save the world, you know. But that isn't his intent. That is not his intent.
Well, I don't know.
He wants those.
Go ahead.
Well, that is not his intent. You can look at his track record. That is not his intent. This is a man that I think bears watching. I think a lot of these people, and I'm going to say this honestly, I think if in a perfect world, these people would be gathered up and institutionalized somewhere because I think they're a danger to humanity. I really do.
Well, you know, he's not gone unscathed. I mean, we've been tracking his contributions, his largesse and the reasons for them for many, many years during the AIDS era and also during the vaccine crusades that he has launched. And he's getting he's having to pay the piper now in India, for example, because of the polio issue there that the world, that he helped fund and the World Health Organization had plied the Indian people with, as well as Nigeria, and they've had the highest rates of polio in the world because of the vaccine. And you can check these records at the CDC's own site. Of course, they don't call the 2 to 9 cases of vaccine polio just what they are and ignore the rest. They call the rest due to natural, infection in infancy and whatnot. But we know that you can't distinguish between vaccine-induced or naturally acquired flaccid paralysis. And I call it flaccid paralysis because, as you might appreciate, polio is 150 different diseases subsumed under a viral rubric because somebody saw a particle in a microscope one day, but yet, they change their definition so many times until they discovered that, they can change the definition of disease altogether by saying that polio is now encephalitis. So after the introduction of a vaccine in a population, they're not going to say, well, our vaccine didn't work. Now we have another disease. It's called encephalitis. And so
we don't know where it came from.
Right. It just came out of the blue all of a sudden, but it was there all along. And due to the, I worked in a pathology department. You get to look at all diseases differently because, diseases are a breakdown of the body, but still the body's functioning. And there was a medicine called nutrition at the turn of the century, which is extremely powerful. And there was many proponents, and it then became known as orthopathy, and the principle is different than homeopathy, but the principles were that, if the body's trying to purge itself, you let it purge itself because that is what is needed. Pain, for example, should not be quelled because pain alerts the nervous system that something is wrong with the body, and so unless you're smarter than the creator, leave it alone or get out of its way and try to help it get the resources that it normally acquires in health. So we study health. We don't study disease in this case. And this kind of thinking is lost to allopathic medicine these days, unfortunately. But, there's more and more evidence and more people, I might add, with all the proliferation of homeopaths, of doctors, of osteopathy, websites, you name it, that are now becoming more aware, probably because of the internet and the ending of the complete censorship of the scientific literature as it has been for decades. It's very difficult to get a paper published, in a scientific journal, and it takes an average of a year or two, on average, I'd say, or sometimes 4 years. I've gone 7 years trying to get a paper published, and you know, when you can post it on the internet, you know, on PLOS Online or something like that, so that everybody and anybody could read it within a very short time, it's a far better system. And all the journals now are wrestling with this issue of the internet because of that very issue. And I think it's good. I think it's things are looking up in that regard. And the more Vioxes we hear about, and huge multi-million or hundreds of million or billion-dollar bailouts of these drugs that harm people, or these surgical procedures, these vaginal meshes that you see on the news, or, you know, if you had this medical procedure, you're now should jump into a class action suit that some law firm is advancing. Well, you know, more and more people are going to get the idea that, you know, these people are not there to help us. They're there to control us, all right, more than anything else. And you know, stepping back from the eugenics issue just a little bit, as I mentioned before, you know, we are all one species. There are no such things as races. I mean, no, really, every marker that you can find in the blood or in genetics in one race is found in other races, all right? So this kind of thinking needs to pervade or begin to break through medical training and scientific views of human life and health, that we are really one family, we are really one group of people, and our only chance of survival is diversity, and that includes immunological diversity. To vaccinate a whole population with the same antigen is—it's much like what the Soviets tried to do with their Lysenkoism early in the century, by you know breeding only what they considered were the best cows with the other best cows. Well, we don't know. Mankind does not know these things, so we cannot know these things because you can't know the future, especially in the realm of biology. I mean, we need to allow nature. Or our natures to be as unscathed as we can become in every kind of situation that whereby the health is broken down or is breaking down. That's my view.
Well, you know, we see the same thing. We call it biopiracy in agriculture, where they have absolutely destroyed, in my opinion, and many other people's too, our food supply by doing just exactly what you said. They have destroyed the diversity. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have this constant regeneration based on the survival of the fittest or the best plants. You have these engineered, crippled up looking plants that produce something that has little nutritional value, and everybody's going, oh, hooray. You know, I want to go back to Africa for a minute. One of my biggest pet peeves, Dr. Maniotis, is UNICEF, which collects contributions from 182 different countries. Yeah. It is the only charity that you can have deducted through United Way out of your paycheck. But they collect billions and billions of dollars every year, supposedly, to bring water, sanitation, so on, to these poor countries, especially in Africa. I sat here one day and over 20 years figured up that they had gotten somewhere in the area of around $4.2 trillion. Now, at that kind of money, I figured there ought to be a toilet about every 5 feet and a drinking fountain about every two in every country over there, and yet we are assailed with ads constantly showing these people living in these dismal conditions with no clean drinking water, no food to eat to speak of, no sanitation, no water treatment, no nothing. Now, this is intentional, in my opinion. This is intentional, and it's means you mentioned nutrition. What they have done is they've kept this system going where there is no clean water, there is no sanitation, and food is scarce, and what is available is non-nutritious. It won't last, it doesn't help, and you see these children with the pot bellies and the orange hair from malnutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why wouldn't the rational man think, geez, these people need food, and they need clean water, and take this $4.2 trillion and go... I just don't understand this kind of malignant thinking. And people keep giving them money and giving them money and giving them money, and there ain't a toilet to be found in South Africa. But it just, this is what I don't understand. See, this is what escapes me. I understand what you're saying. You're very conversational, as I said, in what you say, and you don't talk like, you know, gosh, I've got all these credentials, and you're just kind of stupid. You see what I'm saying? You're very understandable.
Yeah, well, I alert you to the fact, Marty, that there are multiple pathways to these malignancies. Let's call them malignancies as you've labeled them, all right? They don't start out that way in many cases. I mean, you go to a college campus, you know, you've heard of the Coleman walk here that's happening all over the nation for breast cancer, for example. And you see all these,
and that alone.
You know, you see all these young people and, you know, middle-aged people too, you know, who are extremely in earnest about, hey, you know, life is, how does the commercial go? It says something like, everybody deserves a life, you know, and, you know, with such wonderful christening of the outreach intervention that they propose, collecting all this money for cancer research, they're not aware that, you know, 88% of that money goes to buying cars and infrastructure for buildings of the American Cancer Society, for example, who is run by petrochemical company interests. So there's a pyramid, essentially, of planned colonialization of much of the world by these very few extremely wealthy people who do have malignant views of what should survive and what should not survive, and this trickle down destruction that's happening that you are so disturbed by, you know, I don't know what to call it except a lamina. It's laminated in terms of being brought into existence by people with good intentions who really, you know, want to help people, you know, really want to help people. I mean, I've never met a medical student at a medical school I've taught in that, when asked the question, why do you want to become a doctor, who would say, because I want to help people. And, you know, they are sincere. There's no question about it. And we have these organizations such as the FDA that's supposed to protect the individual, and that's their charter. And you have these other organizations that have been set up to, you know, look at populations that are epidemiologically based and so forth. So, you know, if you take a test, for example, and you want to give it to a population, they don't care if half the tests are false positives, you know, because what they're trying to do is protect the population. So they're not interested in the individual damage. So we have these competing forces, you know, and the malignancy that you're describing, I believe, comes up as a result of the intersection of these clashing forces, all right? What we need to do begin to, you know, revise this malignancy is to have a society and a culture that is forward-looking enough. I mean, we don't want to, you know, have a society and a culture that's going to fail. We want one that's going to succeed as a culture for our children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren, and is have the longevity that a civilization as ours deserves, you know. But at the same time, you know, the forces of the market that rule our thinking for the most part. Just the last election, for example, you know, you got a man who says, well, you know, you need a businessman in the office of the White House, not a lawyer. You need a businessman, because a businessman knows how to organize things so that, you know, the society is successful. Much of what's going on in politics today is extremely identical to what's going on in medicine. There's a reductionism, as one author puts it, that just ignores the most common sense things that need to occur so that all children can have, you know, a fair shake at life and an education and a healthy and non-war-torn life. I mean, we're fighting more wars now than we, you know, we have been in quite a few decades that I've been alive. You know,
that's Obama's got a 6-point plan for global war. What the hell did you expect? I want to go back to something that you brought up about. You talked about breast cancer and Susan G. Coleman, and this has been going on as long as I can remember. And I'm telling you, I'm getting up into the decrepit years. I've been pressured many times.
Aren't we all?
Well, I'm a diva, so it doesn't matter. But I've been pressured many times by especially male doctors to get a mammogram. I've never had one. I have no intentions of ever getting one. And the last time I was confronted by a physician who was absolutely outraged that I did not think he was God, said to me, "Are you trying to kill yourself?" And I said, "I'll make you a deal. I said, you go in there and you put the family jewels in there and we'll crush them between two plates and then we'll irradiate them really good."
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I said, "And then when you're peeing out of what looks like a beaver tail for the next week, I'll give you a call sometime next week and let you know if you're okay. How's that sound?" I said, "You go first. If you can live through it, I'll do it."
Yeah. Well, you know, what you say has some merit in it. I mean, the women who are worried about something like that, they should investigate thermograms that are not invasive like that, and they're far more accurate in terms of looking at, tissue in a way that shows blood flow and this sort of thing. But another related issue is like the prostate-specific antigen that, you know, they've beaten older men over the head with for years now. Well, the originator of the antigen, or the discoverer, name is Richard Ablin, who runs the Ablin Cancer Institute in Arizona, I think it is, has, you know, put out page-long ads in the New York Times saying screening for prostate cancer is the greatest evil that he's ever seen. He never anticipated his test to be used in that way, all right? And it creates 49 men who have, you know, incontinence problems and sexual problems for every one that it really catches. So, I mean, this is the discoverer of the PSA, or the prostate-specific antigen. The same can be said with breast cancer. The same can be said for most cancers, all right? And what isn't really discussed, which I'd like to bring the conversation to, I mean, at the end here, is that very little is ever talked about in terms of cancer and vaccines and the huge potential there is. Because when you inject these, I mean, from the very beginning of cancer was discovered in the modern era by a guy named Percival Pott in 1799 because of the boys that went down the chimneys in Great Britain were forced to do so naked so their clothes wouldn't get dirty, and they would get all this soot on their private parts, and they developed cancers there. So we've known for centuries now that foreign agents, specifically hydrocarbons or especially hydrocarbon-based petroleum products, etc., the whole cosmetic industry can be accused of this as well, are capable of inducing cancer. So what does it take to, you know, tell Dr. Offit that, you know, injecting things into dogs and cats? I mean, the Feline Sarcoma Society called me one day and said, "Why is it 160,000 cats a year get tumors at their injection sites and have these proteins expressed in their blood? They have fibronectin, they have laminin, they have collagen, they have cardiolipin, which is a mitochondrial protein. And they have DNA, antibodies to DNA. They have all these antibodies, and they got a tumor. The tumors are typically far more aggressive when they're at the vaccine site or vaccine-induced." And, you know, I hear report after report of, you know, young healthcare workers, since I'm in that kind of situation professionally, that get their first job, they're forced to take a Hep B vaccine, and bang, and within a month they've got, a lymphoma under their arm, of the same arm they got vaccinated in. We have no idea what the burden of cancer is going to be due to this huge, crusade to vaccinate every child on the planet. I mean, at one point, it was getting so ridiculous a few years ago during the H1N1 hoax. They were actually planning. The World Health Organization was holding meetings to vaccinate 4.9 billion people with H1N1, all right? And based on laws of biology that makes no sense, like a virus can jump species from ducks to birds to lions to all kinds, lions and tigers and bears. Well, you know, viruses don't work that way, for one thing. They like all things in nature, they hold their identity over geological time periods. That every time you hear the word, oh, it's mutating around our drug or it mutated around the vaccine, it's hogwash, because you know, the rabies of today is the same as in Pasteur's time. The identity of the virus would then be compromised, because when you change the genetic code just a little bit, you know, it usually spells lethality or disaster. Sometimes it's neutral, it makes no difference, but most of the time, when you change the nature of the genetic blueprint, it becomes completely innocuous or functionless, or it can't reproduce or whatever. So these kinds of basic biological principles need to come to the foreground. The idea that mutation is the real target of all cancer research, for example. And we found that that's not the case. I've published much on this. It's the same thing with pathogens in the environment and stuff like that. With, you know, very few people are aware, for example, that 2% of people that get the flu vaccine will test HIV positive. A number of a certain percentage, a low percentage, granted, not everybody, but a low percentage of tetanus and hepatitis B people will test HIV positive, and then they're given the antiretrovirals for life, which are failed cancer drugs in the case of AZT. We had that put on the California carcinogen list in 2009 after it wiped out a generation of gay men. And, you know, it goes on and on. But it's the biology at the basis of these things that need reappraisal. The herd immunity idea, I say car wax, you know, religious scientific exemption from this medical intervention, which is akin to a tissue transplant. Again, it needs reappraisal, or it needs a revision to include a scientific exemption. The idea that, you know, I mean, you're hearing all these meetings now on gun control. Even Rahm Emanuel tonight is having a special at the University of Chicago on gun control. I haven't heard a single word, not one, in the press about the fact that I think the last 14 or so mass shootings have all been kids on various disturbing drugs such as Prozac and I don't need to mention the names, but and they've all been under psychiatric care.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't heard a word about that. Instead, they want to take.
Well, they're trying to squash that. They don't want you. You're not supposed to think about that.
Yeah, but I've heard of, you know, Marty. I've heard of children that are 6 years old that are on 14 drugs. Now, how can you do science or medicine or anything else with 14 different agents in the brain?
Mm-hmm.
You need, you know, science is a way of holding one variable constant, you know, and or isolating one variable and holding everything else constant, I should say. These are the kinds of things that young people need to be taught, not as my neighbor's kid. I was talking to him tonight after I walked my dog. He was telling me that, you know, at their school, they're making these posters to get everybody vaccinated in the school. You know, they're making
right.
And they're having competitions. To, you know, there's no word of this to parents. You know, I'm going to go to the school board tomorrow and say, you know, what is wrong with you people? You know, why are you forcing these children to, you know, become essentially agents of the pharmaceutical industry in an elementary school? This kid's in elementary school. He's a fifth grader, you know, and he's.
Right.
They're telling him he has to be vaccinated to go to school, and we say, no, you don't. You can declare a religious or philosophical exemption, hopefully soon a scientific exemption, and bring it, like off it says, into the age of science.
Right. We're down to 1 minute here,
oh.
Doctor. I want to thank you. I want to have you back on again so bad. For everybody, I want to read this correctly. It's Andrew Maniotis. Maniotis, I'm sorry. It's ADREW. maniotis.wordpress.com. Please go visit his site, read the material there. It is very readable, understandable. It will turn the light bulbs on all over in your house. Thank you so much for coming on. I truly appreciate this. And I will be talking to you because I do want to have you back. We need to talk more.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Marty. I really enjoyed your show, and I enjoyed Diane calling in. And
yeah,
let's get the word out. I mean, that's what we're here for.
Yes. All right.
Thank you so much.
Everyone, thank you. Everyone that tried to get in the chat room, I'm sorry. I don't know what the problem was. It seems to be a chronic one. But we will be back again Thursday night with the Ruthie Report, voted talk show host of the year on Red State Radio. And she is on our channel every week, Thursday nights at 8. We'll be back Sunday night with our shows on guardian abuse. And until then, talk to you all later. Bye-bye.
Thank you.